herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von TBD. Ich freue mich wahnsinnig, dass wir hier wieder am Start sind. Ihr erinnert euch vielleicht, die letzte Folge von diesem Format war eine Folge, die sich um die Europawahl gedreht hat. Und in einer ganz logischen Folge geht es in dieser Folge um die US-Wahl. Kurz zum Hintergrund, ich bin nämlich gerade in den USA. Ich verbringe hier 2 Monate an der US-Ostküste und probiere rauszufinden, wie Bewegungen besser und effektiver arbeiten können und wie hier Aktivisten in diesem großen Feld zwischen Trump und Klimakrise navigieren, in der ganz leisen und bescheidenen Hoffnung, dass wir in Deutschland und Europa davon lernen können. In meiner Zeit in den USA ist es einerseits super schön, ganz, ganz viele neue Leute kennenzulernen und über ihre Arbeit zu lernen. Ich treffe aber auch immer wieder so alte Bekannte. Und einer von diesen alten Bekannten, der ist mein Gast in dieser Folge, das ist Bill McKibben. Bill ist einer der einflussreichsten Umweltaktivisten der Vereinigten Staaten. Er ist zuerst bekannt geworden mit seinem Buch The End of Nature. Das war der erste populärwissenschaftliche Versuch, die Klimakrise in den Mainstream reinzutragen. Das hat er schon 1989 geschrieben. Es war ein Bestsellerbuch und das war ganz neu für, ja, Umweltliteratur. Später hat er die Organisation 350.org gegründet, eine globale Klimaorganisation und jetzt ganz zuletzt eine Klimaorganisation für Menschen über 60. Die hat er Third Act genannt. Bill ist aber nicht nur bedeutsam und wichtig für die Umwelt- und Klimapolitik in den USA und weltweit. Er ist aber auch für meine ganz persönliche Aktivismuslaufbahn eine wahnsinnig wichtige Person. Der Hintergrund dazu ist, dass ich Bill schon vor 10 Jahren kennengelernt habe. Damals habe ich als Praktikantin beim Umweltmagazin gearbeitet, beim Greenpeace-Magazin. Und ich wurde gefragt, ob ich nicht Bill McKibben interviewen möchte. Der hatte damals einen Preis gewonnen, den alternativen Nobelpreis. Und ich, Luisa, 18, war komplett starstruck und überfordert. Ich hatte noch nie irgendwie ein Interview geführt und war wahnsinnig aufgeregt. Und ich erinnere dann, wie ich da saß in diesem Gespräch vor mir, Bill McKibben, der ist für die Ökos sozusagen eine so Riesenperson gewesen, auch schon damals. Und ich habe Bill zugehört, wie er von seiner Arbeit berichtet hat. Ich habe ihn gefragt, wie er mit der Klimaleugnung in den USA umgeht. Er meinte damals dann, Luisa, die Klimaleugner, die interessieren mich gar nicht so sehr. Ich frage mich, wo sind die Leute, die nicht die Klimakrise leugnen und die doch was tun könnten? Und ich habe diesen Pragmatismus so bewundert. Ich fand seine strategische Sicht auf die Dinge so beeindruckend. Und ich saß da in diesem Gespräch und dachte, wow, ich sitze auf der falschen Seite. Ich will das machen, was dieser Mann macht. Und ja, the rest is history. Ich habe dann angefangen, Klimaaktivismus zu machen und später sogar einmal kurz für seine Organisation 350.org seinen Studentenjob übernommen. Seitdem habe ich Bill immer wieder getroffen. Wir haben viele auch Kampagnen zusammen irgendwie von verschiedenen Seiten begleitet. Und jetzt hier in den USA war es natürlich eine riesen Freude für mich, ihn direkt am Anfang zu treffen. Wir waren beide zusammen auf einer Klimakonferenz, auf einem Panel eingeladen. Wir sind danach lange spazieren gewesen in Boston und es war ein wahnsinnig schönes Wiedersehen mit jemandem, mit dem ich in gewisser Weise schon so lange zusammenarbeite, aber eben in ganz unterschiedlichen Rollen. Weite Teile der Welt gucken gerade auf diesen US-Wahlkampf und probieren zu deuten, was da passiert. Und als ich hier auf diesen Konferenzen mit Bill gesprochen habe, als ich mit ihm spazieren gegangen bin, dann ist mir immer wieder aufgefallen, wie viel Erfahrung dieser Mann in diesen Wahlkämpfen hat. Dass er nebenbei erzählt von der Obama-Kampagne damals und wie das früher war mit Al Gore und überhaupt in den 90ern. Der hat einfach eine wahnsinnig lange Laufbahn hinter sich von US-Wahlkämpfen und immer wieder war er auch maßgeblich involviert. Und genau deshalb schien es so logisch und sinnvoll, Bill in diesen Podcast einzuladen und ihn zu genau diesen Aspekten zu befragen. Ich wollte natürlich auch von ihm hören, wo eigentlich das Klima in diesem Wahlkampf stattfindet und wie er als Klimaaktivist darauf guckt, dass beide Kandidaten letztendlich jetzt nicht die Klimarevolution ausrufen wollen und dass viele Klimaaktivisten immer mehr jetzt gegen Rechtsextremismus und diesen MAGA-Trumpismus kämpfen, als sich um die Ökologie zu kümmern, eben weil die Situation so drastisch und so dramatisch ist. Bill ist diese Tage ein sehr gefragter und vor allem wahnsinnig beschäftigter Mensch. Er verbringt eigentlich jede freie Minute in den Swing States, um mit vielen anderen zusammen dort Wahlkampf zu machen. Dieses Gespräch ist wie viele andere Sachen hier in den USA entsprechend sehr spontan entstanden. Und an der Stelle also ein kleines Heads-up, dass die Soundqualität von dieser Podcast-Folge, ich würde eher sagen, so eine Art ja, bunter Mix ist. Das Wichtigste aber, Bill McKibben, den kann man gut verstehen und damit geht's rein ins Gespräch. Ich wünsche euch wahnsinnig viel Spaß damit. Welcome to the show.
Such a pleasure to get to join you guys. Yes, so we met just the other day and had a bit of a conversation already. But I find it's just a few weeks ahead of the elections. Could you tell our listeners what a day of yours looks like these days?
Well, for the next 6 or 8 weeks, it's mostly about the elections. These feel like the most fateful elections in America in history because they may well decide the future of our democracy. But they also feel like the most important elections in some ways in the planet's history because we're right at the moment when we're either going to accelerate the momentum that's begun to build around an energy transition or, at the worst possible moment, put on the brakes. So beating Donald Trump right now for the next 6 or 8 weeks is the most important thing we can do. Electoral politics, of course, is not mostly what I do. We do big movement building around climate and things. But when those moments arise, they're really, really important. That's what I'm doing. I'm out in the tiny number of swing states that count in America. And you know, we're mobilizing voters, making hundreds of thousands of phone calls, knocking on hundreds of thousands of doors, on and on and on.
Are you door knocking as well?
Oh, yeah.
What does it look like? How does, like, most people don't know door knocking as a concept. What's it like when you knock and then there's someone?
70% of the time, there's either no one home or they don't want to talk to you.
Okay.
But there's enough times when you have a real conversation. Most Americans, I don't think, feel like they get heard by almost anybody in the course of a year. And sometimes the conversations are very moving about what people are concerned about, what they care about, what moves them. In a highly individualized culture like ours, there is something nice about having an excuse to just go knock on the door of strangers and talk with them for a little while.
Since I came to the US, I found it's, I would say, the first election that I'm witnessing so closely where climate plays close to no role, no relevant role. How would you describe that to someone who doesn't live in the US?
I would say it's playing almost no role. Partly that's because of the extraordinarily unusual circumstances of this campaign. A, the single largest issue obscuring all else is the crazy, bizarre nature of one of the candidates, Trump. And B, because Joe Biden, an incumbent, stepped down at the last minute, we didn't have a primary election in this country. And in this country, since we only have the two political parties, that's usually the place where issues like climate come to the fore, where we're able to make the different candidates vying for the Democratic nomination announce themselves on climate and what they think and what they'll do and so on. We completely lacked that opportunity here. Mm-hmm. I think, truthfully, that Kamala Harris is making a mistake in not making more of climate than she does. I think there's a broader consensus than they realize about the need for climate action. And I think they should be boasting considerably more about the work they've done under the Inflation Reduction Act to build clean energy manufacturing and things in the U.S. But they've decided that remember, she took over as presidential candidate 100 days out from the election, mm-hmm. which in a European system might not be the strangest thing in the world, but in America is very, very weird. I mean, we usually have 2 years to get to know we have much too long presidential campaigns. So they've decided that over that 100 days, the issues that they're going to be campaigning on are, one, the economy, because that's what's on people's minds. Two, abortion, because that's the Democrats' other strong suit. And three, they're campaigning on Trump as a crazy man, something he's doing his best to demonstrate with each passing day. So,
and usually when we look at elections in Germany, as climate activists, as campaigners, we always wonder how to make an issue more heard, say the climate. But if I understood you correctly in our previous conversations, you would now say it might even be quite reasonable right now to not go for climate so strongly in this critical moment before the election.
Yeah, I think it's too late to meaningfully change the conversation in this election. I think the job is to beat Trump and get Harris elected and then put as much pressure on her as we can afterwards. I don't think there's any real way to do it now. And the things that do might backfire. You know, one of the great problems that we have in this country because we have this strange electoral system that really only allows two parties to effectively compete is that our third party, the Green Party, if climate-concerned voters go over and vote for it, they'll almost guarantee Trump's victory, as indeed they may well have in 2016, and as they certainly did in the year 2000 when Bush beat Gore. So, I mean, we're talking about climate because that's what we care about, but we're really utterly focused on just winning this election. And I think the way that's most important to do that is to just keep reminding people of what a chaotic, divisive, ugly figure Trump is, mm-hmm. and what a normal figure Kamala Harris is. And we're going to have to count on the fact that there's a deep enough Democratic commitment to action on climate that that will help after the election. But I have no doubt that we're going to have to push them hard. And we have a history of doing this. I mean, I organized, sort of led the organizing for the biggest climate demonstrations during the Obama administration. Obama was a very popular figure. I'd worked hard to get him elected.
Was he a climate guy, though?
He wasn't a climate guy. And that's why we had to go, I mean, we sent 1,200 people to jail sitting in outside his White House, but we did it in as friendly a way as possible. I mean, we told people that if you're coming to get arrested, you should wear your Obama button from the campaign. And we said, we think he wants to do the right thing. We're trying to open up some space for him to do it. We surrounded the White House with 50,000 people, and we said, we're giving Barack Obama a big group hug so that he knows he has this support. I mean, this was not what he wanted. He didn't like what we were doing, but we were doing it in a way that allowed lots of people to take part.
And besides this whole electoral mess up, do you think Kamala Harris understands the emergency of the climate?
I don't think so in any particularly deep or powerful way. But, you know, she comes from California. She's very involved in the kind of California political scene. And arguably, California is, you know, alongside China and maybe Germany, the great source of progress on clean technology in the world.
I watched the debate, as probably many people did. And there was this moment when they talked about fracking and, you know, coming from Germany, coming from a climate movement, it's, you know, for me quite obvious, you know, we need Kamala Harris in office and we don't need to, or we don't want Donald Trump to be there. And yet my heart kind of bounced a bit about this whole fracking thing, right? And I felt like, man, what does it feel like as an environmentalist in the U.S. to fight and lobby and, you know, door knock for someone who would kind of proudly state in a national TV debate that they don't ban fracking?
So the president can't actually ban fracking.
That's an interesting detail.
You do it state by state. We've fought a long, hard campaign to get fracking banned in New York State. But it's the local governors and authorities and things who would have the ability to do that. And in most of the states where fracking takes place, there's no chance of that happening.
Okay.
What the president could do was put it off limits on federal land. Joe Biden said, when he was running for office, that he would do that, that he would stop all drilling on federal land. It's not a promise that he kept. It's a promise that he broke. But he broke it in order to get the Inflation Reduction Act passed. Mm-hmm. He was able to come up with exactly 50 votes in the Senate so that Kamala Harris could break the tie and cast the deciding vote for the Inflation Reduction Act. And the only way he could do that, he thought, and I think probably correctly, was to not ban drilling on public lands. So I think he made dumb decisions that he didn't need to, the biggest of which was, after all of that, agreeing to allow the Willow Oil Complex in Alaska, which I think was a big mistake. On the other hand, he fairly courageously last year stopped granting new permits to LNG export facilities, which any one of which is 20 times the size of that Willow thing in terms of its climate impact. That's the reason that the oil industry is so mad at Biden and Harris and working so hard to defeat them. And whenever I get a little disgruntled with Harris, I remind myself that she is enemy number one, two, and three of Exxon and Chevron and every fracking company in America. And there are, times when the enemy of my enemy is at least my friend for now. I'll also add that climate is the most important issue in the world, but it's not the only issue in the world. And Donald Trump is a repulsive man in other ways. Mm-hmm. And if nothing else, we know that we're going to be going through enormous climate shocks in this country and this world over the next 4 years, over the next 50 years. And we desperately don't need a divisive, ugly, racist, scapegoating son of a as our president. We need someone who has some human empathy and compassion and ability to help people work together to get things done.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that, similar to Germany, climate is quite a polarizing issue here, even more here than back home. Has this always been this way, or am I mistaken? It's not that polarizing as Donald Trump maybe portrays it.
It wasn't always that polarizing.
I remember, wasn't there a conservative Republican president putting solar up the White House and so on?
No, here's that story. If you go far enough back, the original villain here was Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. who took down the solar panels that his Democratic predecessor, Jimmy Carter, had put on the White House in the 1970s. And Jimmy Carter, when he was running for re-election against Reagan, said that he thought solar energy was the number one priority, and he was going to make sure in his budget that America was producing 20% of its power from the sun by the year 2000.
Wow.
If he'd won, and if he'd done that, and there's no technical reason to think that he couldn't have, the climate situation would look utterly different than it does right now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
China would have developed in an era when there was renewable energy to be had. So Ronald Reagan was the original villain here. But his successor, George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, was President of the United States at the time that scientists first publicly told us about climate change, mm-hmm. that Jim Hansen first outlined the problem. So 1988, 1989, that's when I wrote the first book about all this, decades before you were born. So in those days, at the very beginning, it was not a polarizing issue. That Republican president, George H.W. Bush, he had a good line. He said, "We're going to fight the greenhouse effect with the White House effect."
I like it.
It was a good line. And he even kind of meant it, And why not? Because scientists had identified this grave problem. Who wouldn't? But just about immediately, we now know from reading all the archives and things, that the next year, in 1990, the fossil fuel industry came together to decide to spend billions of dollars to build this whole architecture of deceit and denial and mm-hmm. disinformation. And that's what eventually polarized our politics around this.
Mm-hmm.
The oil industry, led by the Koch brothers, our biggest oil and gas barons in this country, mm-hmm. more or less purchased one of our political parties, the Republicans. They became by far their biggest donors. And it became impossible for Republicans to be rational or sensible on climate change without getting defeated in their own primaries. Mm-hmm. The few who tried were soon out of Congress. And so it became this absurd and polarized issue. It's more polarized at the top of the political system than it is at the grassroots. At the grassroots, we continue to find fairly strong support, even among Republicans, for clean energy anyway. But that's the reason that there hasn't been and probably never will be a carbon tax in the U.S. or things like that. The political polarization is simply too large.
And your job is also building those bridges between, people from different sides of the political spectrum. And yet, what do you do if you, quite practically in your work, I would imagine from the outside it to be so exhausting to speak to people about, clean energy and...
There's no way to build bridges across the political divide. There's no people who've spent their lives trying to convince Republican congressmen to vote the right way on clean energy or anything else have been wasting their breath. And there's been a lot who have tried and they've wasted a lot of time. That's not possible in our current alignment. The only thing we can do is try and beat them and then try and persuade the Democrats that we can get to replace them, that they should move more aggressively than they really want to, because they may not be owned by the fossil fuel industry, but they're intimidated by it. And so it's been very painful. It's also been difficult even to get Democrats to move because too much of our labor movement mm-hmm. has been unwilling to speak out proactively, strongly on climate. And they've tended to keep tying themselves to the old industries and the old leaders of them.
Interesting. We had some great campaigning about labor movements in Germany and the climate end. You're probably aware, but people follow the U.S. election mm-hmm. incredibly closely. Mm-hmm. I would think that sometimes people are more informed about current U.S. issues than they are about current German issues. But could you maybe illustrate a bit for our listeners, what can we expect to see under Kamala Harris? Mm-hmm. And what can we, or what should we be expecting in contrast under Donald sure. Trump?
First thing to say is we're paying attention to the good work you guys are doing there, too. And we were very happy to see the work that people managed to do to make sure that the parliamentary elections, the European Parliament elections, didn't go as badly as we feared they might. And we're glad that you're figuring out how to keep AFD as close to the sidelines as you can and all of that. So many thanks to people fighting the good fight in Germany. Look, under Donald Trump, in this country, the fossil fuel industry would be in effective charge of everything to do with energy and climate. Mm-hmm. They would quickly do everything they can to end any of the sort of financial support for renewable energy and clean energy that's begun under the IRA. They'll make permitting for clean energy almost impossible. They'll approve every single project that the fossil fuel industry has their eye on, no matter how bad. The biggest, most obvious example is that Trump has promised to allow drilling again in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which beggars the mind because this is the last place in the world that humans never quite got to yet, you know, and incredibly beautiful. He's even said that he would defund the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which runs the biggest network of thermometers in the world. And the argument quite explicitly in Project 2025 is climate data, you know, undergirds the push for climate action. So let's don't have any more. So, I mean, it'll be terrible. But Louisa, it will not be the most terrible thing that happens under Trump. It'll almost be lost in the blizzard of hateful things that they're doing. It's very clear that the first set of attacks will be on immigrants in this country. He's promised to deport 10 million people. So imagine the chaos that'll overtake the country as he tries to do that. Try to imagine deporting a million or 2 million, or I guess in Germany it would be the equivalent of 3 million people. Try imagine rounding up and deporting 3 million people. Try to imagine what echoes in history that brings back up, I mean, the minute we start discussing it. So that's what the most dramatic and powerful fights will be about. We're not going to have the luxury of focusing mostly on energy policy, I don't think, if he wins. If Kamala Harris wins, the same team that's in place currently, and by the way, I knock on wood, I think Kamala Harris will win. I have just enough faith in my fellow Americans to think we can eke out a narrow victory here. I'm certainly doing everything I can to make it so. And I could easily be wrong. If she wins, progress will continue on the implementation of the IRA. Mm-hmm. There's a very good team in place that I'm sure will stay in place, led by people like John Podesta, mm-hmm. who are figuring out how to do all the permitting and regulatory stuff to get big transmission projects and stuff in place as fast as we can. And will continue to be an important part of, for better or for worse, the global climate talks and things. Probably most importantly, we'll continue in the dialogue with China that's been more or less fruitful mm-hmm. in terms of moving us closer to where we need to go. I don't think that there'll be huge climate bills and action or anything out of the next Congress.
Why?
I think that most of Washington considers that the IRA, that they've given us the present they're going to give us, we should be grateful for it. And I'm afraid that on certain things, there's going to be a great temptation to backslide. I think the most important of these is around these questions of export of fossil energy. It's become a huge, huge industry. from nothing. Until 10 years ago, American companies weren't allowed to send oil abroad. And now it's huge and getting huger. So this is why this fight over LNG, liquefied natural gas terminals, is so important. We've built 7 or 8 of these huge things, and that's producing, we're the biggest gas exporter in the world already. Mm-hmm. But they want to build 20 more. And each one of them, as I say, has 20 times the climate impact of that Willow project. If they get them all built, and this is really, I mean, if the industry got everything that they wanted, and until we kind of forced Biden to pause them a year ago, they'd always gotten everything they wanted. If they got everything they wanted, within some years, American LNG exports would be producing more carbon and methane than everything that happens in Europe. There is an unbelievable amount of natural gas underneath the Permian Basin of Texas and Louisiana. And we're either going to keep it in the ground or we're going to pump it out. And if we pump it out, it's incredibly difficult to make the, climate sums come out okay.
What effect do you think resistant groups against that LNG imports on the other side can have here?
Super helpful. What people have done in the EU has been enormously helpful. To the extent that they've reduced, I think, the threat at least a little bit. I don't think anyone is going to finance any of these anymore on the pretext that they're going to send the gas to Europe, because I think everybody now is quite aware that there is a glut of natural gas in Europe, and there will continue to be because Germany, above all, wisely used the Ukraine invasion as a spur to renewable energy development. And I don't think there's any going back on that. Really, where this gas will or will not go is Asia. And Asia is the biggest, I mean, look, 60% of the world's human beings live in Asia. I mean, to a rounding error, humans are Asians, you know, and they're still on that steep curve in Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, wherever, where they're using more and more and more energy. And so the most important question on the planet is, will they be using renewable energy or will they be using imported gas primarily over the next few decades? And the oil industry is desperate for the answer to that to be exported gas because they have no other real business plan. Mm-hmm. If you're the oil industry, the oil and gas industry, you're in a tough place right now. You know, China last year, this year, has sold way more EVs than they have internal combustion engines. Mm-hmm. And as of last week, you know, the analysts were reporting that Chinese gasoline consumption may have peaked already. And it will clearly inevitably slide because you don't need it to run. So their main business at the moment, automotive fuel, is on the way out. They need a replacement. The only one that they can come up with is burning gas for electricity. That's a stupid thing to do in climate terms, and increasingly it's a stupid thing to do in economic terms. Mm-hmm. Their window of opportunity for hooking Asian countries on natural gas is narrow and closing. If we can hold them off 4 more years, this will be a moot point. I have some hope. I wrote a piece this morning for this newsletter I did, and it had a fascinating, it was the most interesting reporting I've done in a long time. In both Pakistan and in much of Africa over the last 6 months, energy analysts have noted something really interesting. Demand on the electric grid has fallen. People are using less electricity, but their economies are still growing. Now, we know enough about development economics to know that that shouldn't be possible. And it turns out the reason that it is possible is that solar panels have gotten so cheap that in both Pakistan and in much of Africa, and I assume some other places, though we don't yet study it, businesses and people are just putting up their own solar arrays off the grid in extraordinary quantities. Pakistanis this year have put up the equivalent of 30% of their electric grid in solar panels. There's no official statistics anywhere to, you know, show this except for the amount of solar panels that have been sold. But there, you know, there are people aren't registering them. Mm-hmm. But what people have done now is gone on Google Maps and started looking. And if you go look at Hyderabad or Karachi or wherever, Lahore, just looking at rooftops of things, you can begin to see comparing them to a year ago, is massive, massive, massive. There's, in this year, 13 gigawatts worth of solar panels sold in Pakistan, and the entire electric grid is 46 gigawatts. So 30% of, you know, the electric, I mean, that kind of change, if we can...
That's quite remarkable.
That's why electing Harris and other good people and things right now is so important, because we finally have some real momentum.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the fossil fuel industry is so scared. Mm-hmm. That's why they're willing to spend anything to try and defeat these guys. Because if they do, then they can buy themselves some more time.
Mm-hmm.
Look, they're not idiots. They know mm-hmm. that their days are numbered. But they want their days numbered in decades, not single digits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the fight's about. And of course, the reason that fight is so important is we've got single digits in order to save the climate.
Speaking of fights, I would love to turn towards the climate movement with a couple of questions on that end. How would you describe the state of the global climate movement?
I think the global climate movement, oddly, is at a bit of an ebb right now, mm-hmm. a low point. I think there have been kind of two real high points so far. The first was all the organizing, some of which started with 350.org mm-hmm. and elsewhere, that led into Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And that produced a kind of big groundswell that eventually, I mean, that's why Copenhagen went badly and Paris went well. There was enough of a climate movement that leaders couldn't come back to their people and, you know, Obama couldn't come back and say, yeah, we blew it again. You had to bring back an agreement. And so they did. And I think the other high point was the one that you were so instrumental in, the kind of school strikes movement of 2018, 2019, that was a little cut off at the knees by the pandemic, but that had so much power, had built so much momentum, that the talks in Glasgow really reflected, were kind of the Paris of that mm-hmm. moment. And that's when we got all those promises from banks and things. The banks, if you, judging by that, they've all decided that we're no longer much of a threat because they're all reneging on their promises, walking away, you know, whatever. And as usual, the fossil fuel industry has regrouped and they've, you know, figured out how to fight back, especially in America, but other places too. So I do think we need one more big push from civil society
mm-hmm.
to amplify this momentum and get us over the... I don't know what you think, and I'm curious, but that's what I think. And I think that this one has to reflect the fact that the thing that's changed so much is the price of renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
That's, along with the increased temperature, the decreased price of solar panels and wind turbines is the biggest new fact on the ground here.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows us to make... to imagine really, really fast transformative change. But we need another push there.
In your experience, what were good recipes to create those pushes or even smaller wins?
I think we have to change some things. In the past, we've mostly relied on anger, guilt, fear, and sadness
mm-hmm.
as far as the kind of dominant emotions pushing.
Beautiful mix, yeah.
And they're all... correct, they're all appropriate, they're all powerful. But they all max out too at a certain point. And my sense is that they've maxed out, that at this point they're creating as much grief and fear and paralysis as they are robust engagement,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think that we need some sense of romance and adventure and possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the greatest, most interesting moment imaginable, that this transformation towards renewable energy, yes, crucially, necessarily, is a response to the climate crisis. But as we do it, I mean, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings could stop setting things on fire.
Mm-hmm.
That's what human beings have done as long as we've been around. But we don't need to anymore. And if we stopped, it would be as big a moment as when we like learned agriculture and
mm-hmm.
things. It would begin the dramatic relocalization of our economies.
Mm-hmm.
It would end the need for millions of people to die every year from breathing particulates, which is the huge underlooked and underdiscussed part of the fossil fuel equation. And it would return us to... the place where I think we probably culturally most of our ancestors began as people who paid great attention mm-hmm. to this remarkable star which we orbit, that already provides us with light and warmth and photosynthesis, mm-hmm. and would be completely happy to provide us with the power that we need to run our lives. So I think we're on the cusp of something amazing, and I also think we're on the cusp of something apocalyptic, mm-hmm. and I think that it's as stark a choice as humans have ever faced.
And what is it? You told, I would say, quite intriguing story now about what there is maybe for us to achieve and to kind of group up around. And yet you hear this a lot, I hear this a lot, but yeah, let's tackle this question of hope and despair like precisely again, because especially what I see as much of a difference in contrast to 2019 is back then I could tell people this exciting story about this climate thing we're going to do, and there was some adventure in the room, and now people feel like so many things have been tried, and, you know, we've tried everything, but they don't care, and who am I, and I can't do anything. And often I meet people who have not really engaged in any climate activism before, but speak like veterans. And speak like, you know, everything has been done, you know, I don't know. And yes. What is it? What do you tell those people? You will meet them again.
Well, what do you tell them?
Well, I tell them that choosing to do something right now isn't something you necessarily do out of a kind of sense of charity or with a big heart, but it's that until the end of our days, we will live in somewhat of a climate crisis, and deciding to kind of not be scared of the world anymore, but kind of group up to do something much more exciting is maybe the most meaningful investment in our own lives right now, you know, building those tools that we need in probably every moment of that future. You know, when we look into the world and we look into the future, we will find that it's quite tough and it's getting tougher. And there's some things we should get to know quite quickly and we should learn quickly. And I think one thing is how to change stuff before it changes everything, right?
I like that. I think that's powerful. I think you also should be telling each other that while you're in this period of feeling grieving and helpless and whatever, that Germany has gone past, you know, it's now producing half its electricity from renewable power. And that's because people went and did this organizing mm-hmm. and pushed all the time, and that we can do far more. I do think that in organizing terms, we've run into a certain amount of dead ends here. Mm-hmm. Like the first time that someone went and threw a can of soup on a painting, I was like, okay, I guess we'll see how this plays out. Mm. I don't think it helped that much. And I think that by the seventh time, it was like, you know, this is really not helping much. Maybe we should think of something else. And I think that's really what argues for trying to bring in more people in a kind of sense of remarkable opportunity for a deep shift. Think about the world that we live in at the moment. As long as we run on coal and oil and gas, the people who happen to live atop the places where those exist end up with way, way more power than they deserve. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I said earlier, our biggest oil and gas barons in this country were the Koch brothers, and they basically broke our democracy. Mm-hmm. Vladimir Putin has more hydrocarbons than anyone in your neck of the woods, and he used them to launch a land war in Europe in the 21st century. It's super nice to think of a world where those guys don't have much power because the sun and the wind exist everywhere. Think about the scale of things we don't need. 40%, I find people are astonished when I tell them this, so I'm glad I went and reported it. 40% of all the ship traffic on planet Earth is just carrying coal and oil and gas back and forth to be burned, which we don't need because the sun pleasantly delivers energy to every place on the planet every day when it rises above the horizon. It does the transportation, you know.
Destructing the climate is quite inefficient, and I guess most things we would need to do in order to tackle the climate crisis would kind of make sense without the climate crisis, right?
Well, yes, they make sense, and they make economic sense and practical sense and whatever, but there's also a kind of beauty in them.
And a democracy.
I'm a, you can think what you will of me, because I'm, you know, sometimes a Methodist Sunday school teacher. Mm. I'd like energy from heaven, not from hell. You know? And I think that that's where we stand right now.
I like it. And I also like thinking, as a former Protestant, I like to think that we do live on earth and not in heaven. So things that we are fighting for, you know, they're not perfect. And the people we're Amen. Fighting for and office aren't perfect, because this is, after all, earth. So, you know.
Amen. That's a very good thing to keep reminding yourself. But don't remind yourself of it so often that you discount the possibility for real, you know, joy and beauty mm-hmm. in the world either. Mm-hmm. It is a fallen world, and that's obvious to all of us who look around it, you know, mm-hmm. all the time. But it's also an unbelievably beautiful world. And early on, you know, the kind of iconic symbol of the climate movement was the polar bear mm-hmm. on a flow of ice. And then everybody said, oh, we shouldn't do you know, it's about vulnerable people around the world, which it obviously is. 350.org has organized demonstrations in every country on earth except North Korea. And I've been to most of them, and I understand exactly that principle, and it is the most of them. But you know what? People in every one of those countries also love the world around them. Mm-hmm. They love animals. Mm-hmm. They love the natural world. And if you think about the really effective moments in environmental history in this world, probably the most effective of all was the first Earth Day in the U.S. in 1970. 20 million Americans went into the street. That was 10% of our then population, so that's pretty good. And within 2 years, we had Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Environmental Protection Agency. We had all the things that became the kind of template for other countries around the world to devise their own environmental laws. It was a direct result of that kind of activism. Well, there was a certain amount of anger that drove those things. There'd been oil spills off the California coast and a river in Ohio that caught on fire and stuff. But you know what the other thing that drove Earth Day in 1970 was? In 1968, the first pictures of the Earth as viewed from space came back from the Apollo missions. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, people were like, we live on a unbelievable blue, white, you know, pearl floating in this huge black void of the world around us. Maybe we should take that seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we should fall in love with that a little. And for good reason, environmentalists, you know, leftists, work hard not to be cynical and tough mm-hmm. and whatever, which I understand. But now that I'm older, I can deal with more also the idea of falling in love with the world around us and all that it means.
That's beautiful. Yes, you're right. Maybe with all the strategies and all the very tactical planning about stuff and all the politics on it, we sometimes forget about the people's endless ability to love.
The scientists, I think, tell us that there are two hemispheres of the brain. Mm-hmm. I can never remember which is which. Mm-hmm. But environmentalists have done a very good job of appealing to the side of the brain that likes bar graphs and pie charts mm-hmm. and things, and a less good job of appealing to whatever the part of the half of the brain is that responds more viscerally, that responds to music and mm-hmm. art. And truthfully, that was the real reason why it made me sad that people were throwing soup on paintings. It wasn't, I mean, I understood why they were doing it and what their frustration was, and I didn't think it was the end of the world and, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But what made me sad was just that art is one of the great privileges of human beings, that we're the species that, among other things, is able to regard the world and try and make sense of it, and that people felt that they didn't, so alienated from that, made me very sad. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there's room now for the environmental movement to try some different tacks here mm-hmm. that are a little more attuned to that side of the human brain.
I would think it has to do with trust, trusting people that they do feel, and that people will take something, they will take a sign, they will take an energy, and they, you know, will take it on, and their heart and their souls and their minds, they will do something good with it.
I mean, I could very well be wrong here, and I've been trying to convince people in the environmental movement for the last 6 months or so that we should try and organize something like that first Earth Day, but call it Sun Day or mm-hmm. something like that. And I've had very little luck getting people to mm-hmm. want to do it, because they're all like, well, we're fighting the fossil fuel industry, or that sounds hippie, or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is, which I get. And so we, you know, I'm going to just keep talking and writing about some of this. And in the meantime, I'll keep going to jail, you know, outside the big banks and to block pipelines and all the other things too, because all of that's deeply important and right. But movement building you know, this is a new art that we don't... The nonviolent social movement is of almost the same vintage as the solar panel. Mm-hmm. One was born in U.S. labs in the 1950s. The other was born in many ways in the fields of India in the 1930s and 20s. And we don't understand everything there is to understand about how movements are built. If you think about nonviolence, it's clearly, at some level, insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are you doing? You're emphasizing your powerlessness, right? You've gone to jail. Someone's put you in jail. They've taken away your liberty. Mm-hmm. All you've exposed is your lack of power. And yet somehow, in a strange alchemy that has something to do with mysterious qualities of the human heart, mm-hmm. that can sometimes be an extremely powerful thing that changes people's understanding of situations. And we've seen it happen enough times now. And, you know, and in my country, I'm old enough to have watched the civil rights movement at its peak. We've seen it in its most beautiful and powerful, to sense that it was mostly an appeal to heart, not head.
Mm-hmm. I thank you so much.
What a pleasure to get to talk, mostly a pleasure just to get to say thanks to you and to your colleagues. Look, you guys figured out such fantastic ways to organize, mm-hmm. so powerfully. And really nothing has quite captured the mood of the world the way that y'all managed to, with school strikes. And then that you were able to, you in particular, were able to take that energy and put it to work in service of big changes in policy and politics is a textbook case of how to do this work. So we're extraordinarily grateful, not only for the work, but for showing the way for all the rest of us about how to do this stuff. So what an honor and a privilege to get to talk with you.
Thank you so much. That is kind, and I'm very glad to bring your thoughts over to a country in a difficult moment, not as difficult as the US, but heading there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Das war mein Gespräch mit Bill McKibben. Falls ihr mehr von und über Bill lesen und hören wollt, dann kann ich sehr seine Kolumne und Texte beim Guardian empfehlen. Er hat auch einen eigenen Newsletter, in dem er immer wieder über seine Arbeit und die Klimakrise in den USA berichtet. Ich muss ganz ehrlich sagen, ich habe einen riesengroßen Respekt vor diesen US-Wahlen. Ich bin immer wieder sehr unsicher darüber, ob das noch gut aussehen kann. Und ich merke aber bei ganz vielen Menschen, die ich hier in den USA treffe, dass man sich auf so etwas wie eine strategische Hoffnung geeinigt hat. Es bringt nichts, sich jetzt zu vergraben und in den möglichst schlimmsten Szenarien zu verlieren, sondern gerade weil es knapp wird, gerade weil es hart ist, haben hier viele in meinen Augen so eine sehr pragmatisch konstruktive Einstellung zu diesen Wahlen gefunden. Jetzt wird gekämpft, was man erkämpfen kann, und dann kommt man hoffentlich damit weit genug. Ich befürchte auch, dass sehr viel von dem, was wir gerade in den USA erleben, der Populismus, die Fake News, dieses rotzige, respektlose, was wir im ganzen Trump-Lager sehen, ich befürchte, dass immer mehr davon auch für uns in Deutschland eine Rolle spielen wird und dass viele dieser ja sogenannten Taktiken und Methoden der radikalen Rechten sich immer mehr bei uns in Deutschland wiederfinden werden. Und genau deshalb ist es in meinen Augen so entscheidend, dass wir jetzt mit klarem Blick auf die USA gucken und probieren zu verstehen, was hier abgeht, und eben auch zu überlegen, wie wir verhindern können, dass es in Deutschland in solchen Maßen ausartet. Ich glaube, es ist leicht zu unterschätzen, wie groß die Abhängigkeiten voneinander sind. Für die deutsche und europäische Klimapolitik wird es einen riesengroßen Unterschied machen, wie diese US-Wahlen ausgehen. Das hat ja auch Bill so anschaulich erklärt. Und auch für uns Menschen in der Zivilgesellschaft und für die Aktivisten ist es so entscheidend, dass wir uns vernetzen, dass wir voneinander lernen, dass wir nicht dieselben Fehler machen, sondern immer und immer wieder zusammenkommen und probieren, gemeinsam klüger und besser und strategischer zu werden. Zum einen, weil uns die Zeit davon rennt, aber zum anderen auch ganz pragmatisch, weil die radikale Rechte und die Klimaleugner das ja schon längst machen und in ihren globalen Netzwerken sich gegenseitig die Karten zuspielen. In dem Sinne macht es mich umso hoffnungsvoller, dass ich hier so viele tolle Leute kennenlernen darf und von ihren Arbeiten lernen darf und ihrem Einsatz. Und wenn ihr auf dem Laufenden bleiben wollt über meine Zeit hier und meine Begegnung, dann könnt ihr das einerseits in der Taz machen. Da schreibe ich nämlich jedes Wochenende eine Kolumne über meine Zeit hier in den USA und meine Erfahrung. Ich probiere aber auch immer wieder auf Social Media, auf Instagram vor allem, Einblicke zu geben, sobald ich Zeit dafür finde und zu zeigen, was hier alles abgeht. In dem Sinne, stay tuned auf allen Kanälen, wie man so sagt. Ich hoffe, die Folge hat euch gefallen. Bis bald. TBD ist eine Studio Bummens Produktion. Redaktion und Produktion, Kate Kubel und ich, Luisa Neubauer. Ton und Schnitt, Mia Becker.
Die Studio Bummens Podcast-Empfehlung.
Jede dritte Sekunde streifen wir mit unserer Aufmerksamkeit ab. Das passiert dir auch? Guck keine Pornos, meditiere, mach
Wow, Timon, was machst du da?
Ich habe versucht, die Leute zu hypnotisieren, sodass sie unseren neuen Podcast Mind Date hören. Echte Männer meditieren, echte Männer machen Yoga, echte Männer machen Mindful.
Nee, lass mal nicht machen, da kriegen wir Ärger für. Aber du kannst ja einfach erklären, was wir machen.
Mein Name ist Timon Krause, ich bin Mentalist und in unserem neuen Podcast Mind Date geben wir euch regelmäßig kleine psychologische Tricks an die Hand, um euren Alltag besser zu bestreiten.
Es geht um die großen und kleinen Fragen des Lebens, also wie kann ich mich endlich besser konzentrieren, wie hypnotisiere ich meine Freunde oder wie erkenne ich, ob jemand auf mich steht.
Hört gerne mal rein, wir würden uns freuen.
Mind Date. Ab sofort, immer dienstags und donnerstags. Überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.